Welcome to a warm late summer day of just sitting. Taking the time to stop our usual routine and be here in total simplicity and openness. And we happen to today be ending the sitting with this liberating life ceremony. How many people here will be here at the end for that ceremony? I know some people are leaving. Only one. Well, maybe I won't talk about it too much. Talk about it more at that time. But in the spirit of that ceremony, which is releasing live creatures destined to be killed into the wild, freeing them from their fate. They will die anyway, like all of us, but they may have a little bit longer life and maybe die peacefully. And the spirit of such a ceremony is just an enactment, a ritual enactment of the heart of compassion. Of course, there's many ways to enact the heart of compassion. This is just one, particularly focusing on the animal realm, because usually we focus on the human realm. Sometimes we ritually enact freeing the hungry ghost realm from suffering. And in this case, our animal friends, crickets, or whatever other captive animals we might find. So in the spirit of compassion, we might wonder what that has to do with our sitting, our zazen. And since this is a day of sitting, let's make that connection. In our lineage, I think one of the great places this connection is made is Dogen Zenji's informal conversations with his teacher, Ru Jing, in China. His maybe lecture notes, or notes from conversations with his teacher. So young Dogen, he was 25 during this time in China, said to, or Ru Jing said to him, "The zazen of arhats and pratyeka Buddhas is free from attachment, but it lacks all-embracing compassion." So he's talking about the zazen of the Mahayana being a little bit different from the zazen of the smaller vehicles of Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, that are more focused on their own liberation. I think everyone would agree that arhats do have compassion. It would be impossible to be so free from the bonds of belief in one's personal fixed self and not actually be open to other beings. So they do, but it's not all-embracing, all-encompassing, great compassion necessarily, which is, of course, the emphasis in the Mahayana. Rujing says, this is very different from the Zazen of Buddha ancestors, where all-embracing compassion and the vow to awaken all sentient beings is the highest priority. The highest priority. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. It's the first of the four vows. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it comes later. At least in our recitation. Maybe they all actually must go together. They're all different versions of the same vow, really. But the emphasis, the priority, for our own sake, of our own practice, as well as others, is remembering great compassion first. People outside the way in India also practice Zazen, Rujing says, but this Zazen still has these problems of attachment, wrong views, and pride. So it's utterly, permanently different from the Zazen of Buddha ancestors. Shravakas practice Zazen. These are the smaller vehicle approach practitioners, but their compassion's limited. They don't penetrate the reality of all things with wisdom. Instead, they merely improve themselves and thus remove themselves from the creative seed of the Buddhas. So their Zazen is utterly different from that of Buddha ancestors. Of course, we may come to a one-day sitting with the idea of improving ourselves. It's a very natural tendency. And I think this is okay, because that's a wholesome wish. Because usually the way we want to improve ourselves is to be less trouble for ourselves and others, be happy and free. Definitely nothing wrong with that. But if it gets very narrow and focused on ourself and our own practice, without keeping in mind the larger perspective of all beings and everyone being free together, then it's maybe it actually doesn't even work as well. It doesn't actually improve ourselves as much. If we really want to improve ourselves completely, then maybe we actually keep in mind this priority of benefiting and living for all beings. And therefore, we are more free and less focused on ourselves and our own little problems. So kind of a skillful means thing. These compassion teachings, you could say, well, they're really about others. I don't know. It could be really about actually ourselves, a way to really improve ourselves. And it's just the way to do that, to free us from our narrow self-concern, is to actually open to practicing for all beings. We have these, four immeasurables of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And they're all closely related, but they're all a little bit different. Otherwise, they wouldn't be listed as four. So particularly loving kindness and compassion, I think often get kind of mixed together into one thing, but we can talk about them a little differently. Loving kindness, or maitri in Pali, metta, and compassion, karuna. In Japanese, jihi, they're often put together as a compound and almost kind of like just wrapped into one. My understanding is that loving kindness is wishing others well and treating them with kindness, and it's a very uplifting and happy feeling, I think it includes, it's like an emotion, right? A practice of the heart of love and warmth and care. And then compassion is maybe not necessarily so like light and happy, actually, because it's more to do with suffering. It's about not so much wanting others to be happy, but wanting them to be free from suffering. It's almost the same thing, but slightly different, because the focus is more on the problem. wanting others to be free from suffering and actually willing to even suffer ourselves in order to help others be free. Be willing to go out of our way. We might go out of our way to be kind and loving, but even if we do, I think there's a very uplifting, happy feeling of just expressing love and kindness. But compassion might be like something that's quite maybe even unpleasant for us, but we're willing to take it on for others. Yes?
In German, compassion is mitleid, which means suffering with.
Yeah. I think in English too, calm means like together, and passion means suffer. It's like the Christ's passion. So suffering with, yeah. Yeah. So my teacher, Sokhni Rinpoche, at this retreat I was on last month, really emphasized this point. Someone was asking about the practice of Tonglen. It's a Tibetan practice, but I think it's so wonderfully universal that it's kind of made it into our Zen vocabulary a little bit. and understanding. A lot of people have heard about this practice. Tonglen literally means, in Tibetan, giving and receiving, which is kind of like these two sides. It's usually talked about as a compassion practice, but maybe it includes the giving part is like giving in this practice of Tonglen. It's a kind of visualization of giving our like light of our happiness and contentment and peace and joy, radiating that out through our out-breath to all beings, you know, sending them this loving light. And then the receiving part is on the in-breath, breathing in all this negativity and suffering of others as black smoke. So the receiving part of Tonglen is maybe not that pleasant. I mean, these images are not meant to be pleasant, like thick black smoke where you kind of cough and has all these like nasty viruses and, you know, bugs and stuff in it. Breathing all of that in, being willing to receive such suffering. And then, just so we, you know, don't get caught just in that side, dragged, lost in the black smoke, and we breathe out the clear, fresh air of peace. So someone was asking about this Tonglen practice on this retreat and said, you know, I really love this Tonglen practice because it's so healing and it makes me feel happy and I just think it's a great practice. And this Rinpoche got kind of concerned here and said, you know, if you're doing Tonglen to kind of feel good yourself, that's not really Tonglen. It's not that it's bad, actually. It's still good because we need, they were talking about it as like kind of self-healing. We do need this self-healing. And you could use that practice in that kind of way. But that's not the, you know, kind of classical understanding of Tonglen, that it ideally is not that it's a very difficult, challenging practice to really take up, especially that taking on the suffering. And so he was defining compassion as especially in the actually lived compassion, where it's being enacted, as like going out of your way, kind of like being inconvenienced at the least, and actually being willing to actually take on other suffering for the benefit of others. So his example is like, and these are the things, you know, they just don't seem so, it doesn't seem so like a kind of romantic notion of practice, doesn't seem so inspiring, but a kind of classic and maybe common example where we could practice compassion is, and I thought this was a good one that most people could relate to, is like, it's Saturday night and you just made some popcorn to sit down to watch a movie with your sweetie, and having a relaxing evening ahead. The day is done. It's evening time, and a knock comes on the door. And some friend, or maybe not even quite a friend, but a kind of acquaintance, someone you notice a little bit, but that's kind of like, doesn't have a car and feels maybe some like heart difficulty, but they're not quite sure what, and they think maybe they should go to the hospital, and they don't know anybody else to take them, and the hospital actually may be several hundred miles away. This was actually a true story he was bringing up in Crestone, Colorado. The hospitals are several hundred miles away. It's a very remote town. And it is like the last thing you would want to do at that time. But what do? Okay, that plan is nixed. Forget the movie. Maybe we can take the popcorn with us in the car. And we're going to go, because what else can we do? And then the whole time we may be feeling like resenting it. And I think that in this story, I think a true story that was told was like somebody was doing this, and then halfway to the hospital, just after maybe 100 miles, the person said, "Actually, I feel much better now." Maybe it was just a little heartburn. And, but you know, thanks for, and it's great hanging out with you this evening, and, you know, being able to tell you all my problems too. I haven't been able to do that with someone for a while. And thanks for your popcorn too. So, yeah, I needed more salt. Yeah. And that's when true compassion's operating. And it doesn't feel good, right? It doesn't, like, it's not so happy and warm and like, ah, the practice is flowing. I feel like a great bodhisattva. Or we could even turn it and be like, instead of just being willing to suffer there, start, well, what can I get out of this myself besides a little bit of the leftover popcorn? Well, maybe I could think of how great a bodhisattva I am to actually be willing to do this. At least we got that. Yeah, we got that. Like, wow, I gave up my movie and everything for this person who doesn't even really need to go. How wonderful my practice is. And then again, we've lost the compassion, right? Then it's like kind of just for ourselves. We're turning it to just feel happy ourselves about it, right? Still, not so bad, but it's kind of like we're losing the fullness of that spirit of compassion to like, well, let's just see, you know, it's not enough to just be compassionate. Let's try to make it like feel even better for ourselves somehow. So I think this kind of thing is really tricky. And then, you know, then we have these visualization practices like Tonglen, which, you know, technically don't really help the other person. We might feel like, well, just energetically, maybe it does. But it's really a training for ourselves. So maybe other classic examples, and, you know, I can think of examples where I've felt like this way, where the same kind of thing happens, like, you know, this somebody comes and like, no, you know, I'm sorry, I have other plans tonight, I can't take you to the hospital. Maybe somebody else could. But I'll pray for you. I'll keep you in my thoughts, my best wishes. And then maybe during intermissions from the movie, I hope they're well. Again, not so bad, right? Still better than nothing. Some people don't even think of praying or wishing well, doing a little well-being ceremony. All these things are good, but it's like noticing how. And then we can feel like, well, we feel a little bit better about ourselves, like, well, they're probably out there like walking several hundred miles to the hospital and they'll die of a heart attack on the way, but at least I'm keeping them in mind. So difficult, right, I think these, you know, well wishes and prayers for others really are good, really are beneficial. It's definitely part of our practice, but you know, how we can use that because it's easier sometimes than actually suffering with somebody, you know.
I think one of the things I'm relating to as you're talking is also with the approach of Tonglen, is that it seems to be a good instruction just for not turning away from difficulty.
Yeah.
You know, the immediate response is often aversion.
Yeah.
And so it's like helping have a response that's actually, you know, that the first response is to actually receive.
Mm-hmm.
It,
yeah.
You know, but then to not hold on to it, because I think sometimes people get in a lot of trouble. They call it, you know, compassion illness, where, you know, you're always taking on everybody's pain, and then you become this suffering being who can't really help anybody because you're crippled by the pain of others.
Yeah.
So this beautiful, you know, kind of both and.
Yeah.
I'm receiving it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I'm releasing the energy.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
I mean, I've never studied it, and I don't know if that's how they talk about it, but...
Yeah, I think that is the case.
It seems to me like very, you know, even just looking to practice in Zazen, if we have aversion or tightness about something, is the experience of actually breathing it.
Yeah.
Opening to it.
Yeah. The nice thing about that image is, you know, you really are, in this visualization, taking on the suffering. It really is black smoke. And then at the very same time, or the very next out-breath, there is this clear, light, fresh air that you do have. No matter how much black smoke you take in, we do all have this fresh, joyful clarity to breathe out. And I think it's acknowledging that part, that, like, truly the way our nature is that we can't be consumed by black smoke in reality. So it's remembering that side, because sometimes it feels like we're being consumed in black smoke. And remember, well, there's all this black smoke, so where is this clear freshness coming from? Well, that's our like limitless, bottomless well of our nature is always has that fresh clarity, no matter how much black smoke is surrounding us. So these two sides, And then so that we don't get caught in like, I'm nothing but just pure light. It's like then, yeah, and so because we are, we're willing to like, let's take in the black smoke. Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful image of those two sides. Yes, Alex.
So you're taking care of beings and absorbing their suffering, absorbing the smoke. Where does the smoke go?
Mm-hmm.
Or how does it get transformed? Or how do the toxins in the smoke get dispersed or transformed or filtered so that you do not either temporarily or permanently lose your bodhisattva capacity? You just said that there's sort of like a, you said a bottomless pit or a bottomless well of compassion. I think sometimes it really doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, I don't think it's true. I'm not sure if it's actually true.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, this whole phenomenon of burnout
mm-hmm.
would not happen.
Well, we could talk about it like filter is a nice image in this visualization, right? Almost like an air filter on the car that's taking in the smoke and filtering it. And what if we talk about it as a Buddha nature filter? So you're like, because and this is Buddha nature is what comes to mind for me when thinking about this limitless well. It's like, because that is how Buddha nature is talked about. It's like our true nature, and whether or not we're in touch with it or not, there is the teaching that our true nature is this like bottomless, boundless freedom and compassionate resource that is who we truly are. And it has to do with the realization of emptiness of everything, particularly those black smoke particles have no true reality. They're like, they really do appear. So when we breathe them in, we really breathe in that appearance of black smoke. But then the Buddha nature filter, the way it filters them is it like, it recognizes the emptiness of the black smoke, so that it actually, where does it go? Since it didn't really exist in the first place, it doesn't go anywhere. The illusion is filtered out as it comes through that filter into the Buddha nature well that then has this, you know, never runs out of empty compassion. So something like that. But our experience is, just as you say, burnout, and we feel as if the black smoke has filled us up and it's not going anywhere. We can't even take on another particle of it. But sometimes I think it's shown to us ourselves, because sometimes like at our limit like that, like this is, I'm completely full of black smoke, there's nowhere for it to go, I can't take any more, and then something will happen. Something always does. It shifts it. Even something that happened might just be like, we wake up the next morning and it's a new day. And it's like, where did that go? It's not the same as it was. I got some good, you know, refreshing sleep, and now I don't feel the same way. I feel like I could take on some more. So there is the phenomena of, you know, burnout and too much in the relative conventional world, but from this ultimate perspective of Buddha nature, it's like that's not really how things are. So thus, we have those teachings about emptiness and Buddha nature. And do we trust that they're really so? That's maybe our big question. Like when it feels really burnt out or I can't go on or nothing's working, that's when it's like, how can we trust this true, clear nature? Yes, Chris.
Is it possible to sit zazen as a practice and not develop compassion?
Seems like Lu Jing's kind of implying that. And I don't know, maybe if we sit long enough, it's inevitable that our heart will just open more and more. But I think there are types of zazen where we're just, it's more, it's like the zazen that's in a kind of more, a little more closed shell of zazen, and it still might be quite concentrated and maybe quite settled, but it's kind of, I think of it as maybe also is often connected with a kind of dull zazen. We're just, we're biding our time. It's not so open. And it's kind of self-protected. So not so open and kind of like, that's the kind of zazen where, you know, I hope nobody bothers me here. And we're not so open to the rest of the world outside this shell of zazen. And it might be quite peaceful, but it's not so compassionate. So I think that's partly why we, in zazen, we emphasize leaving all the senses open. It's like we're letting the messy world come in through our eyes and ears and body. And we're not blocking it out. I think there's types of meditation that are actually connected with maybe smaller vehicle practices often that are more about blocking out and getting very concentrated, which may be helpful, but they're not as open and permeable as the spirit of this kind of zazen. Yes.
The image that came to mind when you were talking was of natural systems, because those are images from nature help me with my practice. And the image that came up was the image of like the natural, the plants that filter water and sewage and water naturally. Mm. And it's just what they do.
Yeah.
So they don't have an attitude about it, an idea about it. They don't tell themselves stories about it. They just do it.
Yeah.
Which is a very high standard. This is part of what we aspire to.
Yeah.
At the same time, they need sunlight, you know, their own nurturance and a proper environment in which to function. So the ability to just do or just be in that way, I think, also requires that we take care of ourselves.
Yeah, right.
In the way that plants have to be in the right.
Yeah, that's a great metaphor. Yeah, that they can automatically do their work. And maybe they can even do it with, sometimes they're not getting very much, but they're still able to do it, but they have their limits. Mm-hmm. Or the ocean is another one, right? It's like kind of a natural filter of toxins and stuff. But if the toxins get too extreme, maybe they can't, and the ocean's small enough, it can't filter anymore.
I think we're seeing that.
Yeah. So, so I think zazen, and particularly something like a one-day sitting, has these both aspects. It's like this rejuvenating, taking care of ourselves, stopping, taking a pause from a busy life, and recharging our batteries, refreshing ourselves. And at the same time, it can function as this deepening the compassion, the openness. I think that they can go together, right? Ideally, I think they're like the same practices, do both. Take care of ourselves and open. Like zazen, that's what's so great about it. It's so simple and universal, and I think it does nurture and nourish and sustain us with its calming aspects and settling aspects. And it also opens us at the same time. Yes?
Could you say a little bit about the sympathetic joy? Compassion and loving kindness?
Yeah.
Because I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
How is that different?
Yeah. that's a kind of nice, you know, they all kind of balance each other too.
Yeah.
And so loving kindness is more, is this, I picture is more of this kind of like happy, open feeling. And compassion gets a little bit more like, I mean, the Chinese character that's used for compassion, he, like in the Dai He Xin Dharani, is often translated as like sadness too. So compassion, I think, has this, you know, not necessarily so happy quality. And then sympathetic joy kind of comes back again to the other side. Like, it's joy, but sympathetic means particularly joy in the happiness of others. So they're all about opening up this small, limited, separate sense of self. I think all four of those practices, that's what the root is about, actually. Loving kindness, kind of giving the self to others, compassion is being willing to take on other suffering. Sympathetic joy is like, they're getting all the good stuff. I'm not necessarily getting it, but like, instead of being jealous, I will be joyful in sympathy, or sympathetic maybe, not exactly the right word, like in communion with their joy. I'll share their joy.
Cheerleading?
What's that?
Cheerleading,
or even just feeling the joy of others' happiness. And particularly, you could say maybe that with, you know, the challenging part, the real test would be like when we're not getting such a good end of things. So, you know, you could say that they're all antidotes for different afflictive emotions. So loving kindness is an antidote particularly to hatred or anger or aversion. Compassion would be an antidote to, I think, similarly. Does anyone know what the difference is? There some, I think there's a traditional difference that those two are antidotes for.
So, like, when you see suffering, instead of ignoring it or turning away from it or not doing anything, you do something.
Or even apathy, maybe.
Self-cherishing.
In a way, they all, I think, self-cherishing, that is kind of universal through all four also. But yeah, loving kindness, compassion, a little different. And sympathetic joy as an antidote for jealousy in particular, which is a kind of self-cherishing too. Maybe one of the most difficult ones. But the nice thing about it is it does feel good. That is one of the feel-good ones. It is joy, but it's joy at like the successes of others. And all of these can also be directed towards oneself. They're generally about others, because that's where the self-cherishing is often, you know, in opposition to others. But all four, maybe best actually, first direct them towards our so-called ourself, our idea of ourself. So like, definitely loving kindness for ourself, taking care of ourself, compassion for our own suffering, being willing to feel our own suffering, be open to our own suffering. Sympathetic joy is, for ourselves, I think you could say, is actually just being willing to be joyful at our own successes, actually, but not in a kind of overly, you know, not in a way that then puts out like, I'm better than they are, but like just enjoying, especially if we're, you know, maybe if we help others, or we're practicing loving kindness towards others, rejoice in that, in the happiness that comes from that. And then equanimity, you know, like in relation to self-cherishing in others, is kind of like this, you know, the kind of underlying, all-pervading equality of all experiences and all people and all beings and all these different emotions, not being We're not being pushed around by the emotions that come up around the separation of self and other. Something like that. And that's, you know, I think Zazen could include all four of these too. They are like almost like traditional meditation objects in some meditation manuals. We might emphasize equanimity the most in Zazen. You know, just whatever's coming up, just let it be. Equanimity is kind of like let it be. But then, we might think that's all there is to Zazen. So that's what's nice about Ru Jing's thing here is that it also includes this great compassion. So, yes.
So there's loving kindness and compassion and equanimity, and what's the other one?
Sympathetic joy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brahma Vihara.
Brahma Vihara, the means the abode, like divine abode. Brahma is like the highest of the gods and the devas. So right, like the way that these devas abide in great peace and happiness is Vihara means like abode. Also used for monastery. It's like an abode. So divine abiding, divine abodes, and also apramana, the immeasurables, they're also called.
These are also the four.
The four immeasurables or the four divine abodes, two different names
or
for the same.
Yeah,
same list. The very essence of Buddha ancestors, Zazen, Ru Jing says, is the vow to accumulate all Buddha qualities from the moment of arousing the aspiration for enlightenment into the endless future. Buddha qualities would be like these four Brahma Viharas, amongst other things. Buddha ancestors never forget or abandon sentient beings, but have compassion for all creatures, even insects, and crickets, and make a constant effort to rescue them all, and they turn over whatever merit is produced by all this to sentient beings. So this, traditionally, liberating life ceremonies for animals, most commonly in China and Japan and Tibet, all Mahayana countries, I think, do these, some version of this ceremony with animals. And slightly different versions, but they're also like, they're often done as like merit producing, so it helps the beings, but then there's so much great positive energy from that activity of releasing these beings that then you dedicate that merit to particularly like sick people, or it's like sounds like in the Tibetan tradition it's often connected with extending life. So if somebody's like, if somebody's dying, you can, like, there's the belief that freeing living beings extends the life of people who do it. It's kind of like you extend the life of other beings, that extends your life. Whether or not this is true, we don't know. But because of this vow to benefit all beings, Buddha ancestors always practice Zazen in the desire realm in our everyday world of Jambudvipa, which has great opportunities for influencing cause and effect. So basically the desire realm is where beings suffer. So like in if they just practice Zazen in pure lands, where there's virtually no suffering, they can't practice this great compassion so much. So they practice in this ordinary desire realm, the kama dhatu. I, Dogen, bowed to my teacher and said, "How do we attain this flexibility of mind and heart?" Oh, the last sentence of Ru Jing was, "Buddha ancestors practice this way life after life, world after world, and attain great flexibility of mind and heart through this compassion practice." And Dogen says, "How do we attain this flexibility of mind and heart?" That's the Zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors infused with great compassion. And Ru Jing said, to actualize Buddha ancestors dropping off body and mind is the essence of this flexibility. The same old practice that Rujing, I guess, and definitely Dogen says over and over again, Zazen is dropping off body and mind. That is why, Rujing said, dropping off body and mind is called the mind seal of Buddha ancestors. I, Dogen, bowed. So, after all of this talk of like developing great compassion and, you know, practices like, specific practices like Tonglen, you can, it's okay to do in Zazen, especially if you start to feel really narrow self cherishing tightness, it's nice to do. Or I think particularly if you have a lot of aversion towards somebody else, it's a nice practice to like, instead of like getting into your suffering about what they're doing, kind of like turn it towards like, they must be suffering. Mm-hmm. I think almost every time that somebody's even bothering us a little bit, if we look, it's like, oh, let's turn it back. Like, I think they must be suffering. And then we can do that thing of like, let me take on their suffering. It's so radically opposite, right, to like the aversion to how they're bothering us. So I think those sometimes, if I'm really feeling that strongly, I just kind of pop into that like reversal thing of like, oh yeah, just take it in. And it's so such a relief. But of course, as Rujing says, without any of that, to realize this flexibility, and it's this term Nyūshin, like sometimes translated as like soft mind, soft, flexible mind. And that comes from dropping off body and mind, meaning like letting go of who we think we are. Which kind of goes back to, was that Chris's question or Alex's question about, do you think that Zazen always has this compassion? If you just let go and drop off your ideas of who you think you are, will this develop? And maybe that is the subtle message in the end here. Like Rujing didn't say, you should practice Tonglen. Just says, drop off body and mind to develop this. Let go. Open the hand of thought. So let's do it a little more. Let's have another period of dropping. On the lunch break, would anybody, whether or not you're coming to the animal release ceremony, would anybody like to pick up some captive creatures if I give instructions during the lunch break, or even if you're leaving?
Where are they?
At PetSmart. Down at the, it's even walking distance, you know, down at the little mall.
I'm happy to do that.
Oh, thank you.
Go on to my afternoon.
Thank you.
Contribute to the cause.
Thank you.
Are they going to be ordained too, like they were last year?
They're kind of like they take refuge, yeah.
Oh.
Anyway, yeah. Oh. Yeah, the ceremony involves.
True.
Yeah.
Last year they were like right in the zendo. Like
yeah. Yeah, we'll do a ceremony that's the Soto Zen version of the ceremony, I think rarely done in America, where, based on various sutras where they take refuge in the three treasures, and then we teach them, basically, like, the 12 links of dependent co-arising as demonstrated by Shakyamuni Buddha in a previous life, who did this for a bunch of fish who were in a dried up puddle and about to die. He tried to like just convey this dharma to them and tried to like pour more water into the puddle But eventually, the water kept evaporating, and they didn't quite make it. But that that disciple of Ratnashikin Buddha was later born as Shakyamuni Buddha in the Golden Light Sutra. And because of the merit of trying to help these fish, very difficult, like kept having to go miles and miles to get the water in the desert and back and forth to this puddle, and desperately trying to help and going out of his way. Thank you for being here today and joining this dropping off festival, freeing all the living beings in inside our own body that are all tied up in our internal knots. First, we can release them and let them flow through, like go like running through our body freely. And then we can get some others to do the same. We dedicate any merit arising from this Dharma discussion to the liberation from suffering for all living beings. May they be happy and free. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.